Hi, my name is Ben Shattuck, and my book is The History of Sound.
The History of Sound is a collection of linked stories by author Ben Shattuck. Set mainly in New England, the stories are linked perhaps by an artifact or a place or by a theme. The result is a stunning collection with rich detail and beautiful prose. And although it can be difficult to discuss a complete collection, that didn't stop me from trying. From KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network, this is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay, and here's my conversation with Ben Shattuck. So sometimes it can be difficult to talk about a collection of stories, but this is more than a collection. You give us a roadmap of sorts in the epigraph. Talk to me about Hook and Chain and how it relates to this collection.
Right. Hook and Chain is a definition. I don't know if I should say this. It's an invented definition. And I had been searching for a poem form that would describe how the short story collection was set up, which is described as interconnected or linked stories. So the Hook and Chain, just to get back to that, what I was looking for in a poem form, and which I couldn't find, so I eventually just had to invent, was each story. It describes a poem or song form from the 18th century where each line has a rhyming line right after. So it's couplets going through, and the first line and the last line rhyme, if I get that right. And I put an example in the book, A, B, B, C, C, D, D, E, E, F, F, so on until A at the end. The way the collection is set up to have paired stories isn't just because I'm interested in interconnected stories or linked stories. It's because that's a relationship I see when anybody engages in research or historical fiction or books of nonfiction. There's the person in the present, and then there's the event or people or culture or object, artifact in the past, and you're reaching through time to try to animate that thing. And it's not a relationship of 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's a relationship of 1, 2. It's the person in the present and the thing in the past. And it creates this duet almost. And that duet can be harmonious, and that relationship can change over time. And it can be a little bit like music, which is a big theme in the collection, where you're hitting two notes and they make almost a third, more substantial, interesting sound as in a harmony. I see that the way that that hook and chain, and a hook and chain, if anybody doesn't know it, you know, there's a hook at the end of a literal chain, and then you can bring it around so that the final two come together and they're held together by pairs of chain. So that was the best way to describe what the collection, the body, the DNA of the collection, and also to give readers a roadmap, because it would be a very different experience if you read the collection one story later in the book, one story at the beginning, one story in the middle, which is sometimes how I read short story collections. And I really wanted to make sure people read it chronologically as you go through the book, because each preceding story answers some question of the other, either thematically or through a character, or at times in one of the stories, a murder mystery is solved, for instance.
Yeah, I had no idea you made that up. I'm so glad you told me. I thought it was something I wasn't aware of.
I'm hesitant to say, you might be the first person for me to admit that to, and I'm hesitant to say, but I have a very good reason why I want to say that, why I want to admit it, is there are so many parts of the book that are that seem wild and fabricated and couldn't possibly have happened from the past, but are verifiable facts. And there are other parts of the book that seem totally mundane elements of the past, but are invented. And I think Hook and Chain is the first moment where I use readers' assumptions in writers' authority about the past or definitions as a question. that when we, and I think everybody, especially in the past few decades, and certainly past 5 years, as people have been rethinking history, how we frame narratives in the 19th century, how we frame narratives in the past 50 years, in almost any level, both personally or especially on large American history cultural stages, it's a good idea to question what is fact and what's fiction. And I think if you're going to write historical fiction, part of the workshop, of the tools in the workshop, is using verifiable facts and invented, imagined spaces, that reflection on that relationship is something I wanted to build in really early on. And I think it's fun to know that, for instance, that epigraph is invented because it seems so real.
So I read the first story, the title story, The History of Sound, when it appeared in the Common. Which story started it off for you?
This collection?
Yeah.
Edwin Chase of Nantucket is the second story of the collection, and it takes place on a farm, on a secluded farm in Cascada and the outer beaches of Nantucket. And it's about a son and his mother living on a farm, and the whole story takes place over one night. The protagonist is the son in his early 20s who just expects his life to go as without any surprise. And a man, a painter, arrives that night with his new wife, and it turns out that it's the mother's first love, first boyfriend. The definition is pretty open. But he leaves her a painting, and there's not a whole lot more to the story than that, but I think the reader can get a lot more from the story. But in terms of a plot, that's pretty much it. And that story, after I wrote that, I couldn't stop thinking about the painting that he left and how, if it was real life, that painting would be discovered again and who would be on the other side of that discovery. And that it felt too on the nose, too obvious to have a, I don't know if you ever saw the movie The Red Violin, but it's about, you know, a violin through time, and it's about each person who played that violin. I didn't think that was the right way to discuss how artifacts move through history, but my experience with research, with encountering artifacts of the past, is it's less like a direct cause and effect that the objects, the artifacts, the relationships have on people through time, but it's almost like ripples. That the object is the stone thrown in the pond, then ripples move out in really strange and oblique ways. And I wanted that painting to show up again in a way that the characters would reflect a relationship in the first story, but not be directly affected by the lives in the first story. So that's a long answer. But yeah, it was Edwin Chase from Nantucket, and it was an artifact, the painting.
So did you write the next story after that? Or, I mean, how do you, talk to me about your writing process. Did one story lead to the other as you wrote them? Or did you start with a fresh idea each time and then thread them together? Or maybe both?
It really is so dependent on the story. Some are very obviously in conversation with one another. There's a story called The Auk, and then there's a story that is a Radiolab transcript. I also, in this collection could, I think, in some way be called a celebration of short stories in the form. I just try to use every way a story could be told. There's a Radiolab transcript. There's an introduction to a fake historical text. There's first person, third person. I mean, there's all sorts of ways that stories are told in the collection. There's journal entries. There's a story that's a journal entry. Anyway, some of the stories are direct. I planned out, okay, if there's going to be a mystery in the first that needs to be solved, then the second story needs to address that directly. And that was really enjoyable for anybody who goes and sits down for, you know, 4 or 5 hours a day to write fiction. One of the most daunting tasks is to invent everything and face the 1,000 options and choose one option. So to give myself almost an assignment that you have these characters at this time to answer this question was so enjoyable. But with that story, Edwin Chase of Nantucket, I actually had another story that I had published in the Harvard Review that was about an artifact on Nantucket, and that story eventually turned into the other story in The Silver Clip. But the painting didn't show up for a while until a rewrites into that story. And I think what happens, this sounds made up, but it's just my experience of writing fiction. I don't even know how intentional they are. I really see, after having spent years and years writing short stories, that it's just the expression of your subconscious in some way. You know, like, this painting had been floating around in the back of my mind, and it was looking for a place to land. And I had this other short story that almost was discussing all the themes of that first story with a painting, and it just it, it, it I was just waiting to find the door that I could open to that story to insert the painting, and then everything snaps together. I can say also the way, in terms of being intentional and writing short stories and planning the way I write them. Somebody asked me recently why I write about the past, and it's just when I look at the way I grew up, the biggest event in the summer in my town was when we'd all have to bale hay. I went to contra dances and knew fiddle tunes before I ever went to a school dance. I, with my dad, hunted ducks when I was younger. We collected mussels. We fished. There was almost like a glow of times past in my childhood. So when I sat down at the computer to start writing stories, it just made sense that that would express itself. And I think the same way with plots or how stories are interconnected, it's just you receive the signal from wherever, childhood, subconscious, etc.
I want to touch on something you mentioned. Listeners who have been with us a while know that I like to read and listen to the audiobook simultaneously. And this audio was quite a production with an ensemble cast, and one story in the book was a transcript, but in the audio form of the book, it was an actual episode of Radiolab with music and studio recording and phone interviews and sound collected on site. So how involved were you in the audiobook production?
Well, if I can just, plug the audiobook for one second. It is astounding. The cast is Chris Cooper, Ed Helms, Nick Offerman, Paul Mescal, and an amazing cast of readers. If you have a book that spans 300 years with lots of different voices, I knew that the audiobook was going to be really important to this project, that it wasn't just about letting people listen to the audiobook, but letting people experience it in another way. For instance, in the story called The Journal of Thomas Thurber, Nick Offerman embodies a lumberman from 1908. And that is a very special experience to hear. I was involved in the way that I really pushed for the audiobook to be a special, separate experience. And then for anybody who would Google the history of sound, the first thing that would probably show up is not my book, but a movie. And I wrote the screenplay to the film that has filmed and will be out next year in 2025. So some of the people who are involved in the movie, Paul Mescal and Josh O'Connor are the leads in that. It's not a far leap to see how Paul Mescal ended up reading the short story, Edwin Jason Nantucket, because he was already involved in this project.
You know, in the audiobook, we can hear the voices and the characters come to life, but these voices are reading and portraying the voices you created. How do you decide on perspective for your stories, and how do you determine the voice?
Wow, I would answer that question differently depending on which story we were talking about. And that's always a question that's really productive and leads to a richer story. And it's again one of those questions that, as I'm approaching a story, I have to have a real ear for what the language is doing and who would be best to tell that story and how close that story should be. Sometimes, as I said before, the stories are in relation to one another by, for instance, the painting artifacts. Sometimes they're in relation to one another by location. There's two stories that take place over a century on the same farm on Cape Cod. Sometimes those stories are in relation by the themes or the relationships that are highlighted. In one story, a mother leaves her child in Cape Cod. In the other story, a teenager leaves his family. And so exploring that relationship, it was really obvious that I would have to tell one story from the perspective of the woman leaving her child, and the other story also from the perspective of a parent whose child has left, to highlight the concave, convex qualities of what can happen when that sort of break exists in a family unit. Sometimes it was just really fun to play around with form. There's a story that is, as I said, the one that takes place in the early 1900s in northern Maine, a journal entry. I just needed to be so close to that group of men who were logging. And I needed this is just a narrative problem. I needed the character to not know what was going to happen, but have the reader know what was going to happen. So the suspense would build for the reader, but not for the character. And that's kind of like a writing craft example. There's another one. I mean, in so many parts of the book, the qualities of something not being resolved or something being forgotten or something being misunderstood are real narrative elements in the book. So to highlight those misunderstandings, I had to find a way to get the characters into a space where they weren't sure what was happening, but the reader knew what was going to happen. And I would turn around the perspective wheel and see who was best to tell that story. In other ways, and this is kind of to bring one more example. Well, in Edwin Chase in Nantucket, I think the obvious example to tell that story would be from the perspective of the mother whose, first lover comes to the island. But that's a story that I wrote a while ago, and I really wanted to explore the relationship between teenage sons and their mothers, and what a complicated, sometimes devastating, sometimes often misunderstood, but sometimes really tender relationship that can be, and something that I experienced as a teenager. So that one, I was more selfish. I wanted to explore that through a piece of fiction, but it was easier to explore because I just kicked it back 300 years or 200 and some odd years, so I could talk about my relationship with my own mother in a different way.
I have questions here about, both time and location, and you've kind of touched on time a little bit. So talk to me about location. The majority of these stories took place in New England, Boston, Cape Cod, Nantucket, Martha's Vineyard, Maine, New Hampshire, parts of Canada. Do these settings have significance for you?
Oh my gosh, I think a story for me starts with setting. Even though that seems like the wrong answer for a fiction writer, it always starts with setting. I was a fine arts major in college and I took one creative writing class. In that class, I wrote an entire story in which one character is out in the moors, these Bayberry, Huckleberry moors that you find on Nantucket, but is on the land that my family has lived on here in southeastern Massachusetts for the past 100 years. And I remember the note from my creative writing teacher was, "You can't write a short story just about landscape." And I was, of course, indignant as a 20-year-old. I mean, she was right. Of course, she was right. But I don't think I've ever stopped writing about landscape and how it affects people. And I think my first book was about Henry David Thoreau in a way. And I think transcendentalism in New England are so linked. And any writer who's engaged in writing about New England knows how much landscape and how much place affects characters or yourself. I mean, just the first warm day in spring might feel so good after a terrible March that you'd reach out to a friend or do something kinder than you might do a normal morning. The way that winter can really hem in people inside, the way that, especially in New England, this land that people have been living on, maybe a lot of my characters have inherited houses, inherited farmland, how that can really shackle people to destinies they might not want, and how that changes their family relationships. I think I always feel, in terms of writing historical fiction, there couldn't be a better place than New England. You just have to walk through any forest and see a stone wall running through the forest to know that it used to be a field in the 1800s. The landscape is always changing, that the reminders of the past everywhere in the places in the landscape. And yeah, I grew up so close to the land, so close to knowing in terms of New England what it felt like to step on a cold wooden floor in the morning in January and not want to get out of bed, that smell of fires coming from people's chimneys on the first cold day, the joy of summer and the opening up of the ocean, fireflies and fishing and all of that. So it only made sense that my characters would be affected by landscape and inhabit the landscape. And also, I would count my book as one that is in the transcendentalist tradition. So many, if I were to go through and map out these stories, I think so many relationships or revelations or changes in characters come in moments when the landscape is working on them. And that's just my experience. If you go back through the book, you can see when a snowstorm starts or when a snowstorm ends or when somebody's sitting in a marsh, a lot of the relationships really bloom or change or are destroyed in natural settings when something in the land is working on them.
These stories are so nuanced and have such rich detail. There were areas of focus throughout, like the blooming schedule of flowers or types of trees or varietals of apples, or birds, or horse maladies. I assume you put a lot of research into these stories, or are you just a Renaissance man who knows a lot about a lot?
Oh, well, that blooming schedule, that is directly from Henry David Thoreau to talk about that again. And that is just that's accidental research because I read hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages of his journals for my first book. But I always loved reading history, and I loved reading history books. And I would just, I never journaled. I always bored myself to death writing a journal. So I never wrote journal entries and I never took notes. But I did dog ear pages in books. Some of my favorite books are, you know, Sidney Perley's Historic Storms of New England, or I love Albion Seed, or I mean, history books that maybe not I'm saying them seem very, very obscure and not very helpful. But I love little tidbits from the past that seem extraordinary, almost like fantasy, and that give you a perspective into the past. So that only really became more focused. When I was a research fellow at Nantucket Historical Association for, I don't know, a little over a month, and I got into the archives there, and I really started to see the beauty and the amazing surprises that can happen in the past. But I don't think I ever went, maybe a couple times I wrote a story and then went to research. Oh, with a story about the lumbermen in the past, the logging camp, I had to research what they might eat, for instance, you know, those little things. But a lot of time it was, I would find a piece of research and then I would just be reading and a story would come from that. One little story that I can think of is when I was at Nantucket researching the first bank robbery in U.S. history, in which three men from Connecticut in the late 1700s used spoons to break through a number of vaults and stole $20,000 in gold coins. When I was researching that, I found myself so exhausted from trying to untangle all the lies from the past, all the cover up, and I just couldn't figure out the story that I took a break one day and just read some journals from people around that time. And there was a journal entry from a woman in the early 1800s, and it started off with nothing extraordinary, you know, what she had eaten, how her baby was doing, what the weather was like, what ships had come in. But then there's a section in which she described finding out that her husband had a whole other family, a wife and children on the mainland. And then her next entry is, she's writing it while she's at her parents' house. She had run away from her house, gone to her parents' house, and the husband had found out that she discovered what had happened, and he'd come to the house. Her father hadn't let him in, and she described him leaving. And then there's this one little section about how she was looking down at the gift that her husband had left their child, which was little baby shoes on the doorstep, and then he's never mentioned again. So that, I mean, that's like a golden nugget of research I didn't go searching for, but just used a tiny element of that in a story called Graft.
You are also a painter.
Yeah.
And a museum curator, and you own a general store. Do these other interests contribute to your writing?
Strangely, one of the biggest influences in the book had been my time spent at ornithological research stations. So that's like another huge part of my life. After college, I just spent time at research stations, and there's birds everywhere in this book. The general store, not really. it is the oldest general store in America. I love going there. There was a moment when I was standing in the store. It was built in 1793 with my iPhone thinking, oh my God, what is somebody 200 and some odd years from now in this space what are they going to look like? What's, I mean, the space was built before electricity, before anything, before obviously a phone. So it's fun to enter a space that's deep in the past and ask yourself questions that might inform how the stories are written. I think with painting, there are weirdly some lessons in painting that apply on paper to short story writing or any story writing. Something that I came upon when there was a problem with the story and I couldn't figure out how to fix it. And I thought of a problem that sometimes I come across in painting. I haven't painted in a while now, but most landscape paintings or still lives, they have a foreground, middle ground, and background. And I find that if I'm having a problem with a story, I'll just ask if there's a believable foreground, middle ground, and background to a story. The background might be, I don't know, if you're writing in the past, not to use an example from the story, if you're writing about the past, the background might be the Civil War is happening. The middle ground might be this town is caught in the middle of that Civil War, and the foreground is going to be the very intense relationship that the character's having with a brother, a friend, a lover, whomever. And that editorial process that you can bring to painting applies almost directly to story making as well. Yeah, that's what I would say.
Well, the book is The History of Sound. Ben Shattuck, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
That was Ben Shattuck, author of The History of Sound, which was published by Viking. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR Podcast Network. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen. Our producers are Haley Krausen and Katie Lanning, and our marketing coordinator is Carly Cooper. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.
Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.